Welcome to this episode of Modern Practice. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva, practicing internist and associate vice president for clinical resources at Vizient. Today we'll hear from the University of Nebraska, where a known and respected team of experts is leading the fight against COVID-19. This team will discuss the challenges around diagnosis and treatment, use of medication, and innovative approaches they've used with PPE. My colleague, Lindsay Mayer, senior director of Vizient's collaborative program, leads the discussion. Let's hear what they had to say.
Welcome, everyone, to our weekly Vizient COVID-19 webinar series. My name is Lindsay Mayer, senior director in our collaboratives program, and I'll be your host for today's webinar again, Evolving Practices at Epicenter Organizations. And I'm going to turn it right over to our first presenter from Nebraska Medicine, Dr. Angela Hewlett. Dr. Hewlett is associate professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases and medical director for Nebraska's Biocontainment Unit. And Dr. Hewlett, the floor is now yours.
Thank you. So I'm just going to briefly touch on some of the clinical aspects of the care of patients with COVID-19. First of all, the University of Nebraska Medical Center received an early group of individuals diagnosed with COVID-19 who were medically evacuated from the cruise ship Diamond Princess out on off the coast of Japan. And so we've seen actually since then, you know, obviously our own patients here from Nebraska as well. And in this group of patients, as well as our early group, we've seen a very wide spectrum of clinical illness with this disease, and essentially from patients that were virtually asymptomatic to very mild symptoms to severe life-threatening disease. We have not had any deaths as of yet, fortunately, but that obviously is a complication that can occur with this. We know from some early reports out of China that 81% of individuals infected with COVID-19 seem to have uncomplicated illness, likely not requiring hospitalization, generally very mild illness. About 14% require hospitalization for oxygen or other supportive care, and 5% require intensive care unit admission, which includes everything from acute respiratory distress syndrome, sepsis, multi-organ failure, and even death. Older age and the presence of various comorbid conditions, things like chronic heart and lung disease, diabetes, immunosuppression, and other things are definitely risk factors for severe disease and death, especially in the reports out of China. And we don't really have a lot of information in specific populations, namely in children or in pregnant women and neonates. We do think that children generally have a mild illness based on some reports early, but again, not a lot of information in that arena as of yet. So diagnosis of this illness is by PCR, and that's generally an upper or lower respiratory tract sample. As you know, we have limited testing capabilities throughout the United States, which I'll touch on in a few minutes. Supportive care is really the mainstay of treatment for this illness, and those include things like supplemental oxygen, very conservative fluid management, evaluations of complications, organ failure, and such via various laboratory examinations. And then really closely monitoring these patients for clinical deterioration, which according to many reports and based on our experience here, seems to occur during the second week of illness for the most part. There are definitely exceptions to that, but that does seem to be a trend. We see both rapid and gradual clinical decompensation. So some patients do relatively well for a while and then gradually start to not do well. And we've also seen rapid decompensation as well. You know, we need to recognize early respiratory failure as early as possible and support those patients with potentially intubation, mechanical ventilation. ECMO has been utilized in select patients at certain centers for this disease as well. Now, you probably have heard about a myriad of investigational therapeutic agents. These are being heavily covered in all of the news media. So remdesivir is a broad-spectrum antiviral agent in which there's actually a randomized placebo-controlled trial currently in progress in the United States and is currently still enrolling patients, and we're hoping to have some preliminary data fairly soon in that trial. Chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine obviously has been covered very broadly in the media. There was a small uncontrolled study that showed a reduction in RNA in respiratory specimens without really any discussion of clinical outcome. U.S. trials on this are planned for a variety of different uses, things like everything from post-exposure prophylaxis, pre-exposure prophylaxis, and then also treatment. Of note, these drugs have a very significant side effect profile, and we've also seen some reports of deaths and also, you know, very significant side effects based on the use of these drugs, especially when not monitored. Lopinavir-ritonavir, there was a recent randomized trial that demonstrated no significant clinical benefit, but that one was of interest early on, and then there are multiple other agents as well. So just very quickly, clinical and operational challenges that we're seeing in the clinical care of these patients. So, and I know we all understand this, but this is a very rapidly evolving situation. Changes in guidance, changes in clinical management recommendations, as well as operational management are just occurring every day. And so this is something we're having to keep a very, very close eye on a daily, if not hourly basis. We also don't really know the prevalence of this disease in the community due to our lack of testing capabilities, which is, it can be very problematic. You know, testing itself can have a long turnaround time. We don't really know the sensitivity and specificity of the tests yet, how many tests are really needed in order to rule out or rule in this disease. We also have some issues with inconclusive test results as well, which is very frustrating from a clinical standpoint. You know, there are no FDA-approved therapeutic agents, which is something that hopefully will change in the future. But as of now, we don't have anything approved to treat this disease. And there are lots of difficulties based on, you know, in patients that are in the hospital, mainly with hospital discharge planning, needs for things like skilled nursing beds, homeless populations, you know, people that are living in group living situations. Where do these individuals go when they recover from this illness? And then we obviously are having issues with allocation of resources, namely hospital beds, ventilators, and other things, and PPE shortages is a big part of that. So on that note, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to my colleagues, Dr. Rupp and Terry Michaels, to discuss PPE considerations. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Hewlett. So this is Mark Rupp and Terry Michaels joining me. What I'd like to do is just briefly cover a little bit about infection control and the personal protective equipment that's used in the care of these patients, which would include, obviously, good hand hygiene. There's good data that these respiratory viruses can be picked up on your hands from surfaces or contaminated from droplets and then inoculated to your face and mucous membranes. And so it's good to do good hand hygiene. The personal protective equipment that is recommended for this includes gowns, gloves, and eye protection. And then from respiratory protection, the CDC recommends that N95 respirators be used whenever possible. Or PAPRs, but when supply runs low, using droplet precautions with a simple procedure mask or surgical mask along with eye protection is acceptable. PPE, particularly the N95s and PAPRs, need to be prioritized for what we call aerosol-generating procedures. So these are anything that's going to induce cough and the production of small aerosols. And then we try to perform those aerosol-generating procedures in an airborne isolation situation, meaning that we have negative pressure in that room. So our approach here at Nebraska Medicine has been that we have formulated dedicated care units within the hospital to cohort patients as well as the providers caring for those patients. As the epidemic has evolved, we've been converting over additional real estate within the hospital to take care of those patients. So we cohort them on particular units along with the patients and staff. We use N95 respirators for all patient care activities on these units, and that will continue as long as we're able to maintain our supply, along with gowns, gloves, face shield, and goggles. We prefer the face shield over the goggles, but if we run low on those, then the goggles that protect the eyes will also be appropriate. And then we do have a program to preserve our supply of N95s that we'll go over in greater detail, as well as preserving our face shields and goggles and glasses. It's extremely important that your providers feel confident in their ability to put on and take off their personal protective equipment. And we've gone through a lot of work trying to develop educational materials, having them very, very easily available to everybody, teaching videos, as well as just-in-time training with hands-on experts that can show folks how to do this and make sure that they feel comfortable in this very important aspect of patient care. We've developed a really vibrant extended use and a reuse campaign, and Terry Michaels will go over that in greater detail now.
Thank you, Dr. Rupp. So as we learned from our colleagues around the country, We are hearing from hospitals that just have one surgical mask per day or per shift, insufficient supplies of respiratory protection and eye protection. And so our initiatives were really to safeguard our supply and how do we use it judiciously. And so using national guidance regarding extended use and reuse was important to us. And so to put together some guidance for our healthcare personnel on how do we reuse these safely so that we can extend our supply. So preferential treatment of extended use is preferred over reuse. So again, so what can we do to cluster our cares between patients so we can extend the use of our respiratory and eye protection while doffing our contact PPE such as a gown and glove and performing hand hygiene. So I'm going to give credit to our frontline team in the biocontainment unit for coming up with some great methods to how do we reuse this. We've used handled bags and actually sling our N95 over a handle and the same with our face shield so that we can preserve them in a way without being crimped or creased or altering the shape of the mask. We do have guidance on how we can reuse our face shield so that in terms of doffing order, that comes off and then we can hang it off the front of our bag so it's clean and disinfection. It's dedicated to a single user. And then our N95 are also over a handle. So we label the bag front and back. So as we doff, front becomes the front of the mask. And so we are uniform in how we doff and use our brown bags. We've also implemented a command strip, or just a hook on the wall, I should say, that we can hang these handled bags at point of care.
People are writing their names on their N95s along with the first date of use. And then the people who are reprocessing the N95 respirators are putting a small tick mark each time that the mask or the respirator is decontaminated. We know that the coronavirus in particular, as a single-stranded RNA virus, is extremely susceptible to germicidal irradiation. In controlled studies, anywhere from 2 to 5 millijoules will kill this virus. We have done some validation studies with various types of bacteria and other viruses to show that the amount of germicidal irradiation that we're applying to this very, very readily inactivates and decontaminates the surface of the respirator. We've actually gone up multiple fold and have a good level of safety cushion on the amount of irradiation that we've delivered. And there's decent data out there to indicate that the filtration capacity of the respirators are not impinged. We're asking each and every time we go through the decontamination process that we visually inspect the respirator and that people test the elasticity of the bands before they put it on and really stress the bands as another measure of the physical integrity of the respirators. By doing this, we think that we're very safely and effectively extending the life of these respirators. I'll be the first to say that this is not approved by the manufacturer. There is no regulatory guidance saying that this is appropriate. But again, we feel that doing this is better than wearing a bandana. So, we're in the real world here, and we'd love to be able to have a supply that we could throw these away every single time we encounter a patient. But that, unfortunately, is not the reality that any of us are living in. And so we're trying to go forward with something that we think is safe, something that we think is effective, and will allow us to continue to care for our patients.
Good morning. This is Frank Venuto. I'm going to run through this very quickly. We're a little pressed for time, so I'll be happy to take questions at the end. One of the things that I would encourage all of you to do is to set your operating principles and goals. A couple things I want to really think, have you focus in on. One, make sure colleagues' safety and well-being is of paramount importance. Transparency of communication is critical. And think about how you're going to recover from all of this whenever this pandemic ends. And I do believe it will end at some point, and that's our belief. So one of the things we looked at in terms of retention of key staff is we created a flex staff policy or flex scheduling redeployment policy to keep people and vital staff paid, especially after we had made the announcement of reducing elective surgeries, elective procedures, and elective admissions. You had to have a way of retaining staff. This was our way of doing it. We've pulled these people. We have them now prepared to be deployed. We've also allowed other things like pay for quarantine period if it was work-related and allowed PTO extension of maximum. of maximums. Reducing stress, panic, and misinformation, we have used Dr. Rupp in our colleague forums and leadership forums to really talk very specifically about COVID-19, its impact on them personally, as well as what we are doing for PPE across the organization. I can't stress enough the importance of giving them facts because they're listening to news shows just like everybody else, and they create a level of panic. Couple of things we've done that I think have been very effective. One, we have weekly frequently asked questions that are updated actually daily. If necessary, we have a weekly forum with the executive team that we do a teleconference much like this for our 9,000 employees. And we give them updates, and we're very transparent with our information. We'll tell them what we know, what we don't know, what we have in terms of PPE or what we don't have, what our testing is, and also think about childcare support and also reducing any consequences around attendance policies. These things seem small, but they're very critical and vital to each of our colleagues. Then really preserving full time. Again, we put this flex staff in play. One of the things I will tell you principally what we've said is we are trying to use all of our current pay practices as they exist. We have not established any hazard pay or special call pay for anybody. Any kind of disability issues associated with the disease go through our normal disease management. And then the other thing I want to say to you is really provide that mechanism for redeployment. Right now, we have more staff than we need, but as soon as COVID hits here and our staff start to experience the disease itself, we expect that we will be redeploying lots of staff throughout, and we've already set that mechanism up and are testing the deployment right now. And then lastly, not to be forgotten, you have to manage your own staff's fear. They will get medical certifications that they can't treat COVID-19 patients. You need to have a process set up for that. Visitation practices and processes have a great impact on our staff. Our staff is very stressed about having to manage visitors as much as the COVID-19 patients. So pay attention to your visitation policies. Pay attention to their personal health needs. And we are balancing our decisions with our university partners and our provider staff. So when we make decisions about colleagues, we're also looking at the impact on physicians and vice versa. So sorry that was so short, but I want to get to Dr. Cavazzaghi.
Hello, everyone. My name is Kelly Cavazzaghi. I'm an internal medicine physician and have the pleasure of serving as the vice president for education at Nebraska Medicine, and am helping to help train up the workforce to best prepare for our approach to COVID-19. A couple things that I just wanted to share, as my colleagues prior to me had talked about the just-in-time training, as well as the importance of maintaining a healthy workforce. We've developed quite a bit of just-in-time training to help our colleagues to do that. We specifically have focused on several key competencies, such as the donning and doffing of PPE, how to collect specimens, particularly when you have such a limited supply of testing, as well as patient transport, as well as a variety of other things. We've developed short video vignettes that include both auditory and visual learning, knowing that everybody learns a bit differently. From that, we've actually been able to develop infographics, which can be used directly at the point of care, as well as providing detailed steps for resources and having all of those available. One thing that I think is really important to note is the need for high fidelity versus high tech. It is so important, I believe, to have the employee look at the video and see what they are going to encounter in the moment, as opposed to what the ideal state is. The ideal state is great when we're learning about a topic, but when we need to apply it, seeing exactly the gowns and the masks that they're going to be wearing is important. Dr. Hewlett had mentioned the rapidly changing protocols and checklists that exist on our website. We've been able to house a tremendous amount of these, and I think it's important to have that on a centralized location as opposed to scattered amongst different users. One of the things we found to be really important is how those are organized and labeled. And I put there to have a clinical brain, and what I mean by that, one of the useful things for me being a physician is being able to understand how the physicians think and what they're going to be looking for. Putting that on our web designers is unfortunately not a great thing. simply because they don't know the context. We've also been able to provide, you know, provide recent updates because people come back to it. And that meets the last part there, wanting to be able to push the users to the website itself as opposed to attaching something to an email. Simply because if it changes daily or every other day, we want people to go to the website consistently to find the most recent information. What we're working on next is identifying one-pagers for volunteers to support frontline personnel so that when we do reach that surge protocol, those individuals can be trained literally with a 30-second or 1-minute introduction to what they need to be able to do. From there, that's all I have, and we'll hand it back over to Vizient.
We have a lot of questions. Let's get to a few of these. How can you tell if a N95 mask is no longer functional?
That's a good question. And again, we've got good data to suggest that we can reprocess these respirators multiple times, probably 20 times, without really worrying about interfering with the filtration capacity or the elasticity. So we're asking folks to go through the usual fit testing that they would do at the bedside, you know, put them on, make sure that it fits correctly. If it doesn't, we're asking them to go ahead and discard at that point. In addition, before they do that, they're stretching the elastic bands very rigorously to make sure that we haven't lost any of the elasticity. If they're going to break, we want it to do it while they're testing it rather than when they're in the room. So those two things we're asking our providers at the bedside to do very rigorously each and every time they go ahead and don an N95. And we think that by doing that, we should be in good shape. We're still tweaking the protocol as far as how many times we will do the reprocessing. Right now, we kind of have it slated to do a 7 times, 7 tick marks, and then the folks who are doing the reprocessing will toss them out at that point. So we're trying to be very careful, trying to be very safe. Again, we're in uncharted territory, and again, I know this is not authorized by the manufacturer or the regulatory bodies, but again, we think it's the right thing to be doing.
Are your staff washing hands before removing gloves?
We've, on some protocols, we have them gel gloves prior to. So based upon the doffing order, we might gel gloves. If I'm going to take my gown off in a room and before I step out of the room, I'm going to doff my gloves, gel, and then again, make don gloves, clean gloves, to take like my face shield off. So it really is depending upon the sequencing, the protocol, when they might gel, but we have used hand sanitizer on gloves.
The important thing is that we have really nicely detailed algorithms and the order in which healthcare providers are supposed to do the donning and doffing. And so it is a little difficult to remember each and every step. And so we have those reminders right there at the bedside of what step comes next, as opposed to folks having to commit that to memory.
Okay, thank you very much. I would really like to thank all of our speakers, our guest speakers today. I know it's probably an understatement to say you're extremely busy. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing our expertise. Thank you to the audience also. I really hope everyone please stay safe out there. And I hope you have a great day.
That's a powerful team leading the charge against this deadly virus. I want to thank them for joining us in this important and timely episode of Modern Practice. And please join us for other podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thank you for listening.